So this image is striking fear in some of your hearts because you're thinking, we just took the offering, and why is he standing up there with an offering plate? We'll get to that in a little bit, but I'll just put it right here for right now, and that'll be a part of what we talk about this morning. Last week we talked about, in our series on 2020 Vision, seeing things clearly, and the idea of, instead of getting trapped in materialism, which is our life consists of what we have, and it's all about us, and so what we have is really about just making our lives more comfortable, our lives happier, if we want to use that term, that God challenges us with a different perspective. And his perspective is, yes, I bless you with things, but I bless you with things so that you can be a blessing to other people. Yes, we can enjoy things. That's part of God's blessing in our lives, but it's never meant for us to start to think that my life consists of just getting more and more and more, and somehow that will fulfill me. No, God has created us for something much, much greater. He wants us to be generous, not greedy. It leads to a deeply fulfilling life of purpose. Remember, God doesn't need our money. He doesn't need our time. He doesn't need our talents. He could accomplish what he wants in this world with or without us, but he invites us into what he's doing, so that he can bless us, so we can experience the blessing of being engaged in God's mission in the world, and he can use us to be a blessing to others. That's the way he's chosen to do this. So this morning, I wanted the second part of this section on generosity, and next week we'll move on to another topic, but I want to tell four stories this morning, if I could, with you, and I hope that these will drive home some of the points that we not only talked about last week, but also that we'll talk about this week. And the first story is found in the Bible in Mark chapter 12. It's a story of Jesus and his followers, his close friends, so I encourage you to turn there, if you would, page 1005 in the Pew Bible, Mark chapter 12. We're going to pick it up in verse 41. Jesus and his disciples are in the temple area, and they're sitting in one of the courts, and this is a court often known as the treasury, because this is where people would go to give their financial gifts to the temple, and that was part of their duty as followers of God, as Jewish people, to go and to offer their gifts. And so in this area, it would be helpful for us to understand what's going on. People would come in, and there would be different places for them to give their gifts. We'll get into that in a moment. Jesus is kind of off to the side with his disciples, and he's just observing what's going on. And so that kind of sets the stage. In verse 41 in Mark chapter 12, it says, Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put. So there he is, and he watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Now, again, this outer court, they probably had, from what we know, 13 different chests, and these chests were offering boxes, and they had like this trumpet-like thing. You'll see an image that looks similar to it right there, or at least what we think it looked like, and you would put your gift in that top thing, and it would drop down into the box, and there were 13 of these around this court for different purposes, and depending on where you wanted your gift to go or what you were there to give towards, you could put it in one of those 13 receptacles, and everybody would just kind of come and do that. It was a kind of a come-and-go kind of a thing, and on your way to worship at the temple, this would be a part of what you would do. But just think about these words. Jesus is sitting there, and he's watching the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Now, in our culture, we would call that awkward, okay? Because I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that this morning, and don't worry, we already took the offering, okay? But imagine when you came in, we did it a little differently this morning. And there were 13 plates lined up along the front of the platform here. And during the offering, we just said, everybody, come on up and just put your gifts in the plate. Oh, wait, before you do that, elders, leaders at Davis Oak, would you please come up here and stand up here and just, you know. How would you feel? I mean, that's so against our culture, right? You know, to be watched while you're putting your financial gift into the offering by the leaders of the church, let alone everybody else who's out here or maybe doing the same thing. I mean, just to process that for a minute. How would you approach that? Try to do it in a way that, you know, doesn't draw attention to yourself, most likely, because we don't want to do that. In fact, we've been taught that we're not supposed to give for show. We're supposed to do it as an act towards God. But that's basically what was going on. And Jesus is observing, his followers are observing what's happening. And what do they observe? They observe, we pick it up again, verse 41, many rich people put in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins worth only a few cents. So they see two things. two things, and there's a contrast here. One is many people, one is a widow. So there's many people doing this, only one person's doing this. Of the people who are many, he says many rich people. They were well off. They had financial resources. And in the case of the widow, the contrast is she was poor. She didn't have very many financial resources. Now, it's interesting. They both came to give. They both put money in. They're both giving of what God has given to them. But one seems to draw the attention of at least maybe the disciples. The other seems to draw the attention of Jesus. Now, what is she putting in? This idea of two small copper coins is the smallest denomination that they would have had. If we figured out to today, those two coins equaled about 1/64th of a day's wages for a laborer in their culture. So let's just say, for example, you're making $15 an hour laboring somewhere. This would be about a little less than $2. Okay, so let's just say, for example, she's coming up with her $2 to put in there, but for her, it's all she had, we're going to see. It's not just $2, there's no more in the bank. There's no more in the wallet. There's no more in the purse. This is all she's got, and she's going to deposit this in there, and it certainly makes someone notice. Now, if you had people, honestly, let's go back to our illustration. In their day, they'd probably have their money somewhat like this. So imagine these are filled with coins that are worth quite a bit of value. So you're watching and you see people come up and they've got this and it's, I mean, you can just hear it, right? You can hear it going in. You can watch and say, wow, look at that. That's impressive. Look how much that person gave. And let's be honest, if we were watching and we were paying attention, and if somebody gave up and somehow we knew it was a very large gift, that would probably draw our attention. We'd probably be like, wow, that's pretty significant. And I think it did in that setting as well. In fact, I think there were some people, not all of them, who were doing it just simply to draw attention to themselves. Jesus addresses that actually right before this passage of those who were doing things for show. But I would guess that perhaps it drew the disciples' attention as well, because larger gifts tend to draw our attention. I remember a couple of years ago when we were, just to give you a history if you haven't been at the church for a while, when we built the wraparound to this building that we're sitting in now, in 2004, we took out three mortgages to pay off and to handle the construction in addition to what we raised here at the church. And over the course of time, we were working on that first mortgage and had gotten to the point just a couple of years ago, we were ready to pay it off. And it was a great celebration to pay off that first one, which was for $500,000. And we, on a Sunday, celebrated the fact that we have crossed that line. We have now paid off our first mortgage. Now we're going to launch, you know, we've been paying all three, but now we're really going to focus on the second one, which has about $350,000 left in it of another $500,000 loan. And we're going to really go after that one. And I remember it wasn't long after that Sunday when we celebrated that Bill Kern, who was our business administrator at the time, comes in my office and he says, I got some good news for you. Now, when your business administrator walks in your office and says he has good news, you want to hear what he has to say, right? He says, someone in the church, and they want to remain anonymous, has stepped up to pay off the second mortgage. They're going to pay off the $350,000 about that's left remaining on it. And he's like, what did you say? And he reiterated with a smile on his face what had transpired. He said, they don't want you to know who it is. Don't ask me, because, of course, what's the next first question I'm going to ask? Who did this, right? They don't want us to know, but they want to take care of this. And so within about a month, maybe 6 weeks of celebrating paying off the first mortgage, we were able to celebrate paying off the second one. And now we're working through the third, which was much larger. I think we're about, by the end of the year, we'll be about 600. I'm just kidding. So that's about where we are on that one, right? Just so you know, Lord's blessing, we're continuing to pay it down. It's good. It's in a good place. But those are the kind of things that make you go like, wow, you know, like, man, that just seems really significant. It really helped us move forward in a significant way. And I think there's a lot of times when, of course, our hearts are drawn to those kinds of things. In fact, in our culture, people who might give big gifts that certainly get attention, and I'm not trying to say they always do it for attention, but you see hospitals, universities, name buildings after people who give large amounts, and yet Jesus draws his disciples' attention to something they probably would have missed. In the midst of people, many people giving large gifts, Jesus chooses to single out one person who's giving next to nothing, because he has a point that he wants to drive home. So verse 43, calling his disciples to him, they're all kind of sitting there watching, each watching whatever they're watching, and Jesus is like, guys, come here, I want to show you something. And it's almost like I'm going to say, what did you see? Did you see something like hugely significant? Like, what are you going to show us? What are you going to talk to us about? And he draws them over, and Jesus said, truly I tell you, listen to me, hear me, because it's so important. It's going to go counter to what you think. It's going to go counter to what you may be watching and paying attention to. Let me draw your attention to this poor widow. I don't think she knows this is happening. We don't get that impression, but he's just doing it kind of discreetly to his disciples. But he does point her out. This poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. Now, I don't know if they observe what she put in. I don't know if that raised questions like, wow, how could a poor widow put in more than everybody else? And the bottom line is, Jesus' statement isn't actually true. She didn't put more in than all the others. The others probably put more in than her. Almost everybody who walked in there probably put more in than she did. So Jesus is looking at something more significant than just the amount, at least in his eyes. And he goes on to say this. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything. All she had to live on. It reminds me of a message that Pastor Matt did years ago when he had a poker chip and he talked about living all in. You know, living all in. This woman was all in. She put it all on the table. She said, this is all I've got, but I'm giving it. And we're not told why. We're not told anything about her. But what we do know is this. The amount wasn't greater, but that's not really what Jesus was talking about. Her sacrifice was what was greater. He saw her sacrifice, and he recognized that for her to give what she gave required greater sacrifice from those with much resources who gave far larger gifts, but for them it wasn't the same level of sacrifice. And Jesus wanted to point out and say, I see it. No one else is going to know. No one else is going to look at her and be like, wow, look at that as an example of giving. Probably she would not be singled out for that, but Jesus does. And to this day, we read about her testimony of giving, even though it was such a small amount. Why? Because she gave out of sacrifice. More important in God's perspective, because what he really wants is not just our money. And please, especially if you're new to church, like, hear me when I say that. Maybe your perception or maybe your neighbor's or friend's perception is that churches are all just about wanting your money. Do we take an offering? Absolutely. Do we use those offerings to further the mission of our church? Absolutely. We do those things, right? But we shouldn't be an institution that's constantly just asking for money for ourselves. We should be using what God has given us to be a blessing to our community and to the world. And that's what we seek to do here at Davisville, as well as take care of our facilities and our staff and those things as well. We seek to balance those things. But you see, God's more interested in our hearts. Because if God has our hearts, then everything else will fall into place. And so what he pointed out in this woman is, I think he's pointing out saying, man, her heart is in the right place. Her heart is about saying, God is so amazing that I'm willing to sacrifice to the point of everything that I have for him. Just because, why? We're not even really told, but what would lead somebody to do this? See, it changes the question. When I'm seeing with 20/20 vision, when I'm seeing from God's perspective, I focus on my heart in giving, not just the amount, and I let what God's done in my life be the impetus to say, what can I give? When my heart is full of gratitude for what God's done for me, it changes the question. Because honestly, when it comes to giving, and I know we're talking about financial resources, and it's really so much bigger than that, but we'll talk about that right now. The idea of financial resources, we often ask, how much do I have to give? I get asked this, what does God expect of me? Am I supposed to give 10%? Am I supposed to give above that, below that? How does this work? Am I supposed to tithe off my net, off my gross? I get asked those questions on a regular basis, and they're fine questions to discuss. But what if the question changed from how much do I have to give, but how much can I give? How much can I give and yet still maintain, you know, what God wants me to do to take care of myself and my family, but how much can I give? That's probably not how many of us, including myself, often approach giving. Why would she do this? Why would she give all that she had? We're not told. But we can guess at a couple things. She did it trusting this God that she was giving all that she had to. Because where else could she go? She just gave all her money away. What else is she going to do? She somehow was trusting that God would ultimately take care of her. Somehow she was potentially overwhelmed with who this God was and maybe what he'd already done for her. Even though she was poor, that she just wanted to show this kind of devotion. I think of the woman who took that expensive jar of perfume and used it to anoint Jesus. And the disciples said, "What a waste. We could have sold that and used the money to help the poor." And Jesus said, whoa. Her heart's in the right place. Out of devotion to me, which is appropriate, what she's doing is a good thing. When our hearts are filled with devotion towards God, when that's driving what we do with our financial resources and our material possessions, then we're in a good place. It certainly wasn't for show. Jesus seemed to catch her in the act, so to speak, but didn't seem like anybody else was paying particular attention. And Jesus has some strong words, like I said, in the passage right after this about watching out for the teachers of the law. I'm sorry, the passage right before this. You can read that in Mark chapter 12. Just back up a couple of verses, and you'll see Jesus give this warning about people who want to draw attention to themselves. In fact, he even uses the phrase, they devour widows' houses, and then he talks about a widow. This very widow who might have been a victim of the system that was in place is willing to give all that she had to her Lord. So what happened to her? When you read stories like this and they just stop, like we don't know what happens to her, we don't ever hear about her again, my heart goes to, well, what took place? Like, what happened to her? I want to know the rest of the story. And we're not told. But let me tell you story number two, which might shed some light on God's heart and how he, I think, would have approached this widow and her future. This story is in the Old Testament. It's about one of God's servants named Elijah. He was one of God's prophets, and he was prophesying and teaching the people in a time when the nation of Israel had gone down some very bad roads. In fact, basically, they had become just like all the other nations around them. They were worshiping in particular this one god, Baal, and there was about to be this showdown between the real God and this false god, and we're kind of getting set up towards that. And Elijah, because Baal was seen as the god who provided crops, he was the fertility god, he was the god who made it rain. Well, Elijah, under God's direction, challenged Baal directly in saying, it's not going to rain for a period of years. Ended up being about 3.5 years. That was a direct challenge to Baal's authority because he was the one who made it rain and made crops happen. So Elijah, under God's direction, is saying, you want to see who really has control over the rain? It's not the one you think it is. So he makes this proclamation, which you can imagine made him somewhat unpopular with the ruling class. So king and queen, Ahab and Jezebel, are kind of out to get him. And God says, look, flee to this place. There's a ravine. There's a brook there. I'm going to feed you. I'm going to take care of you. And that's what Elijah does. So he's in this place kind of on his own, and birds are bringing him food, and there's water there, and he's got what he needs, but he's certainly in a risky proposition. Well, as the famine begins to hit because there's been no rain, this brook that he's getting water from dries up. He has no water anymore, and it seems that he's in another desperate situation. And so as we pick up the story, you can read it on your own if you want in 1 Kings 17 later on. That's where you'll find it. But just to summarize, God says to him, listen, I want you to go to this town called Zarephath. Now, it's interesting. He just says, don't go to a town in Israel. I want you to go to a town outside of Israel. I want you to go to people who, right in the heart of Baal country. I want you to go right in the heart of the place where people are worshiping this false god. Because in that place, I've directed a widow to supply you with food. That's all he gets told. I love how God like leaves things very nebulous in a lot of ways, right? Ever feel like that in your life? So go there. So he goes. And when he goes, he comes to the town gate, and there, sure enough, is a widow picking up sticks, probably from people who have come into town with firewood. Sticks drop off the cart. She's picking it up. She's very poor. She is next to nothing. We're going to find out just how close she is to the edge. And Elijah observes her, and he says, well, maybe she's the one. He says, well, he starts with, would you get me a drink? And she's willing to go and get him a drink. And maybe he sees that as a positive sign. So he takes the next step and he says, oh, and also, would you bake me a cake? A cake meaning like a loaf of bread. And bring that to me. So here he is, this foreigner coming into her town, asking her for food in a time of famine. And her response is pretty interesting. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she says, she recognizes who he is, or at least who he represents. And she says this, I don't have any bread. All I've got is a handful of flour in a jar, and a little olive oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it. And then she says this, and die. She, in her mind, this is her last meal. She will gather what she can. She'll use the rest of her resources. She'll make a little bit of food. Her and her son will have it, and then they're out. There's nothing left. And with the famine in the land, she has no hope of gaining anything else. And in her mind, they're going to die. So Elijah says to her, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. In other words, go ahead. Make what you're going to make for you and your son. But first, make a small loaf of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. Now stop right there. It has all the feelings of a charlatan, doesn't it? You know what? You go ahead and take care of yourself. But before you do that, take your meager resources, make something for me, bring it to me, then go back and take care of yourself. You know, don't you almost get this feel like, I would be extremely uncomfortable in this situation. It seems like Elijah, this representative of God, is demanding. He's not giving. He's demanding of this woman. And she has a decision to make. Amazingly, in my mind, and then he goes on. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. You recognize that I represent another God than the one that you worship here. So let me tell you what he says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. So you're experiencing a famine because of drought. I'm telling you, my God is telling you, if you do this for me, then you will have what you need until rain comes, which will then supply the crops so you continue to live. He will take care of you if you're willing to give it all now. Oh. Can you imagine as a mom in that situation? Do you trust this guy? Do you really believe that this is going to happen? What are you going to do? What are you going to decide? Something, and we're not told what the something is, but something in this woman's heart resonates with this man and this God that he represents. Or maybe she simply says, look, we're going to eat one meal and die, so why don't I just take a chance? The worst we're going to have is not have any meal and die, but we could get enough to keep us going. I don't know how she saw this. All I know is that she did it. She went away and did as Elijah had told her. She made the cake for him, brought it to him. Then she went home. And as she's going home, I'm wondering what she's thinking. She just used up all her flour, all her oil. She has nothing left. And as she set that jug back on the shelf or wherever it was and went off to take the bread to Elijah, can you imagine coming home and there it still sits? And in your mind, you're like, it's empty. This is silly. Like, what? I'm an idiot. Why would I believe? And I don't know what she's thinking. She comes up to it, and she takes it, and she goes to, and there's oil in there. In that moment, she sees God provide for her in an amazing way that I think generates additional faith in her and leads her to believe in this God that Elijah has talked about. It says, so there was food every day for Elijah. He ends up staying with her and her son, and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. And I wonder if in the same way that God provided for that widow in Zarephath, that God took care of the widow who gave all she had in the temple that day. That's what I believe, but I have nothing to really back that up from the scripture. But why do I believe it? Because that's God's character. God's character is such that he loves to see us be generous. Why? So that he can take us to the breaking point and have us fall down our face and not be able to continue? No, so he can step in and say, look what I can do. When you trust me, look what I can do. And he loves to do that for us. Now, what does this look like in the church? Here's story number 3. If you have your Bibles open again, turn now to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. This is page 1146. So now Jesus has returned to heaven. Paul is making his missionary journeys. Churches are being planted all over the known Roman Empire. And as I said last week, 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 are some key passages that talk about giving and how to approach it and some principles that we should use. But I just want you to tell you a story about an example, because Paul uses an example to help motivate other people in their giving. In verse 1, he says, and now, brothers and sisters, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. The Macedonian churches would be ones in Philippi, Thessalonica, that region. So in other words, he's talking to the Corinthians about churches in a different region. It'd almost be like saying, hey, you people in the suburbs, I want to tell you about some churches in Philadelphia and what they're doing. You know, just relate it some way to something around us, but we're not necessarily in. He's going to challenge them based on their generosity. He said, what do these Macedonian churches do? He says, verse 2, in the midst of a very severe trial, they're going through a very hard time, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. And I find that so interesting. Notice what they had. They were in extreme poverty, and yet they had overflowing joy. We don't usually associate those two things. We usually associate, if I'm going through a really difficult time, the last thing I'm usually experiencing is joy. But somehow, even though they were going through a really tough time, they were experiencing God's joy in their life. They had something greater going on than just their dependence upon their material resources. And they allowed their extreme poverty and their overflowing joy to come together and well up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. So they said, here's what we can do, but we want to do more. And we're going to take the next step, perhaps like the woman who gave all she had. And notice he says this, entirely on their own. We didn't coerce them. We didn't put them on a guilt trip. We just let them know of the need, or they found out about the need. Entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the Lord's people. They heard that there were people in another city in need, and they pleaded, let us help them. Can we come alongside? Can we help them in some way? We'll collect. We'll send. We'll help them out. And Paul's just overwhelmed by what they did. And he goes on in verse 5, and they exceeded our expectations. We might have thought, well, you know what, they're going through a hard time, so maybe they could do this. And they said, oh no, we're going to the next level. And this is what they did. They gave themselves, here's the key, first of all to the Lord, and then by the will of God also to us. And what does he mean by that? They made a decision, and they said, everything we are and everything we have belongs to God, first and foremost. Every follower of Jesus should come to this conclusion. That everything we are and everything we have ultimately belongs to God. It's His. And then once they came to that point, then they said, so how much of what God has given us that really belongs to Him, we're just stewards, how much of these resources are we meant to move on to some people who are in a desperate situation? And that made their decision perhaps that much more clear for them. They gave themselves first of all to the Lord, and then by the will of God also to us. Why? Because for the follower of Jesus, generosity flows out of our relationship with Christ. When we understand what He has done for us, that motivates us to be generous to those who are around us. There was joy. There was joy in their generosity, even though they were in a difficult situation. They gave themselves first to the Lord, and then they gave themselves to others. That's God's call for us as well. I want to share a fourth story. So we've learned about the widow in the temple. We've learned about the widow in the country outside of Israel and Elijah. We've talked about these churches that Paul references. And what he's really saying is, hey, Corinthian church, look what they did. He has no qualms saying, hey, just look how they live this out. You might want to follow their example. And I want to share another more modern day example with us, just to challenge us. This is the story of Tom and Bree. They live in California, and they made a decision, as they'll represent in this video, early on to live a certain way so that they could have resources to share. And this is a little bit of their story and what God did in and through them. Let's watch this together.
I was at Earthlink for 10 years, and while I was there, you know, Earthlink stock went public. And overnight, my stock options were, you know, several million dollars. I show up to work the next day, and there were administrative assistants showing up, you know, in their new, you know, LDTTs, and VPs showing up in their, you know, new Mercedes-Benzes. And I came to work with my my car, you know, the 91 Geo Metro, you know, three cylinders. I'm Tom, and this is my wife, Bree, and we live in Pomona, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. It is the fourth largest city in LA County. It's bigger than Pasadena, but it is also the second poorest city in LA County. So that's a lot of poverty over a large population.
When I was in college, Isaiah 58 convicted me of God's love for the poor, and I felt like I didn't understand his heart for the poor, and I wanted to because I wanted to understand more of God's heart. And so because of that, I moved to Pomona, California, to the inner city, to work with the poor and see how God worked and what his love was like.
When we were engaged and decided that we would live at or below the medium household income level for the nation, we looked at our budget and we realized that one of the first things that was going to get impacted was this honeymoon trip that we had been talking about, this overseas trip. What's amazing is a year later, we get a call from Target and they said, congratulations, you've won our honeymoon giveaway sweepstakes. And they said, and you registered for a Califon Pan.
Which we still have.
Which we still have. And they said, that automatically entered you into the Califon Target honeymoon giveaway sweepstakes. What we won was a 7-day, all-expense-paid trip to Tuscany, Italy. It was really amazing. But what I remember from that time was Bree turning to me and saying, this is God. Confirmation that he will take care of us, that he will be generous and he will give us more than than we can imagine. And that's been true. Growing up in the suburbs, I never really got to know many people. I never got to know my neighbors. People would drive their cars into their garages and go in their house and come back out through their garages, and actually never saw anyone. And one day Bree and I were walking down the street in front of our apartment, and two boys stopped us in the street. And they asked us if we knew the Bible. And we said, yes, we do. And they said, would you teach it to us and our friends? And we said, sure, yeah. Come to our apartment Wednesday at 5 p.m. You know where we live. And we'll teach you the Bible. And so they show up Wednesday, 5 p.m. with half a dozen of their friends. Every week they show up to study the Bible. I've never had that happen to me before in the suburbs. But in a place where there's a lot of darkness, even the kids know, they feel, that there's got to be something more. There must be something better. And we get to be a part of that light, be part of shining God's light here in this neighborhood.
Living in Pomona in the inner city gives us a lot of unique ministry experiences. There was a girl named Jenny who I had known for many years, and we invited her to live with us at the point when her life started to fall apart.
Well, in the first month, she put on 10 pounds because she was just eating regular meals again and getting up at a normal time, getting to school. I went to the high school and got her transcripts, and she was still failing every class across the board. But in the remaining 12 weeks of school, she got all her grades up. She finished with A, Bs, and Cs. That year, as with other years, we continued to live on the medium household income level, which was about $45,000 that year. But on Jenny, we probably spent an extra $30,000 just on her.
We saw Jenny's life completely change in 12 weeks from being a very undernourished and depressed young girl to really coming alive.
And it was amazing that God would have us be a part of that transformation for her in her life.
And I think we have to just believe, as people who follow Jesus, that our lives can make a difference when we follow him in what we're called to do. I had heard from a good friend, neighbors that we'd known for 15 years, that they were not living in their apartment anymore, and they were living in their mom's place with a heroin addict in the living room and the TV on all night. And I could see in the kids' faces that their life was just crumbling and that they really weren't doing well because of the environment, even though Irma's a great mom, Jerry's a great dad. You can't really raise a family in a living room with people coming in and out and heroin needles all around.
Rhea and I started thinking about the idea that maybe God was calling us to invite the Reylesses, Jerry and Irma, and their kids to move in with us. It was amazing to be family together. And it was, you know, similar to when we had Jenny live with us, you know, the sense of family, her being part of her family, the power of family.
When the Reylesses left, you know, I knew there was emotional challenges for Cadence some of the time, right? Because she did lose some of her space and she did lose some of her toys. And I asked her afterwards, well, what did you learn?
It was hard, but if you let it happen, your heart gets bigger and there's more, and there's room for more people, so it's really worth it.
People will come to Tom and I sometimes and ask how they live their lives radically or, you know, following Jesus in a similar way we do. And there's the one answer to that is you really have to ask Jesus what he's given you and what he's asking you to give away and what he's asking you to hold on to. So there's no formula for what kind of life to live. There's only a listening to Jesus and a conviction. And all you have to do is ask how with what God's given you.
Powerful story. Just being willing to let God use what he's given you. I love the idea that, you know, they made the tough decisions before his stock, you know, ended up being worth millions of dollars to live at the median level in our country. They gave up a honeymoon, and a year later, God blesses them with a week-long trip. And I let that sink in. Like, it's that moment of saying, God, I'll do this. I'll give this up because I sense this is what you want me to do, and I want to do it for you. Do we really believe he's the kind of God who is actually saying, I'm so glad you did that because I can't wait to bless you? Or do we actually think he's the God who's saying, yep, that's good, now give me something else. Give me something else. What's our heart towards God? How do we view him? And that in so many ways will determine our generosity. When I understand that God is a generous God, and all that he's already given me, that will motivate me to be generous, trusting that he will take care of me. I love their answer at the end. It's not about just following their lifestyle or someone else's lifestyle. It's about you and me asking God, what is it you want of me? What do you want me to give away of my time, my resources, my talents, of my words that I'm using? What is it you want me to give away, and what is it you want me to hold on to? And let him be the guide in that determining factor. So as the team comes up, can I just ask you to bow your heads before we sing this last song? And would you wrestle with that a little bit? And you may not get your answer now, but could you at least start the conversation with God? God, first of all, thank him for his blessings. Recognize what he's blessed you with. And then be willing to ask the question, God, what do you want me to do with what you've given to me? God, thank you. Thank you. Help us to just be overwhelmed with gratitude by what you've given to us. Not just materially, although you have blessed us. But you have given us every spiritual blessing in Christ, Ephesians tells us. You've given us a home after this life is over, with you, in your presence. You've given us your presence right now to comfort us, strengthen us, provide for us. You've been good to us, even though we go through extremely difficult things. Your goodness shines through if we're willing to look for it. We thank you for all of those things, and help us to hear your heart. For each of us, you've given us different resources. Some you've given us much financially or materially, others not as much. But in all of us, as followers of you, you call us to be givers. Help us to wrestle that through with you and then to joyfully offer to you, trusting that you are a God who is generous and loves to give. It's your nature. Help us to believe these words that Jesus, you said, give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Help us to be generous, knowing that we can never outgive you, God. Thank you so much. In your name we pray. Amen.